Our next case today is 053679, the United States against Shelley. Oral argument has been waived in this case, so the court will consider it submitted on the briefs. The next case is number 063287, the United States against Logan. Mr. Habermuel. Mr. Habermuel.
Good morning. May it please the court. The single issue on this appeal, in my opinion, is whether simply being arrested for possession with intent to distribute drugs is sufficient reasonable suspicion to support a body cavity strip search at the police station once you've been arrested.
Mr. Habermuel, I take it there's no issue in this record about the manner in which that was done. It wasn't done out in the middle of the public room or anything like that.
That is correct. It's simply the fact that it's a strip search itself. There's nothing else I could identify that was objectively unreasonable about the manner in which it occurred. I was somewhat surprised when I did the research. As far as I can tell, this court hasn't actually ever just faced this issue directly and ruled on it. The cases we tend to find were all mostly in the context, actually, of civil rights cases. But I did find three that seemed to have something to say about it: Burnham, Brack, and Krishar. And in that regard, I have to correct an error I made in my brief, which I apologize for. On page 8, I referred to the facts in Brack as being the defendant having been observed trying to hide drugs and continually denying presence of drugs in the car even after they were found. That's, in fact, the facts in Burnham. Sorry about that. In Brack, the defendant had arrived at the police station, and the first words out of his mouth were to ask for some toilet paper because he said he had to go to the bathroom, which, since that's the first time the officer had heard about that, the officer found suspicious. And in the other case, in Krishar, the officer had actually seen the defendant putting something down the defendant's pants. So in all three of those cases, you have something besides the mere fact of the offense itself.
Let me ask you this question. Yeah. Suppose somebody had introduced in this record, which, of course, is not here, but suppose somebody had introduced in this record a study done by professional association or the Bureau of Prisons or someone talking about the number of times people try to smuggle drugs into correctional facilities like a jail or like a prison and the number of times they use body cavities for that smuggling purpose. And let's suppose further that it's a high percentage of times, 30% of the time that's how they're discovered or something like that. My main question is, do you think a study like that would be necessary, or do you think that the jail officials and the police can take into account before they book somebody that body cavities are a place where people hide contraband? I mean, certainly you can read the cases and you see that that happens with some regularity. I'm not in a position to tell you whether it's one case in 1,000 or one in 100 or what it is, but...
Well, that's the fundamental problem. The only case you see are the ones where they did find it. You don't see any of the cases where they didn't, and you can't draw any statistical conclusions from that.
But the jail officials, you would agree, do have a serious interest in keeping the jail free of smuggled-in drugs.
Certainly. The Supreme Court agrees with you on that, too. I could hardly deny it. But
so why can't they do a body cavity search if body cavities are a way that contraband could get into the jail?
Because, as the Supreme Court has said, the question isn't the interest being served. The question is the means by which you serve it. And there's a fundamental difference between patting people down, looking in their clothing, whatever, a normal search, and a body cavity search. The Supreme Court has drawn, I think, a pretty clear line in the sand. And this court has, too. You need some actual reasonable suspicion to justify the particular search. And I think that's the thread that runs through all of this court's cases. It isn't enough that conceivably they could have been there. I don't think might is the same as reasonable suspicion.
What if the jail had a policy that every person who's booked has to spend the first, 2 days in a dry cell? No bodily intrusion there, but if you are hiding something, it will appear in time.
I guess I don't think that's a search. I'd have to admit that if all they're doing is collecting bodily waste, they're really not searching the person. But again, that's the whole point. They aren't taking their clothes off. They aren't looking at them naked. They're not intruding their fingers into bodily orifices. And that is the whole point. That's the nature of the search in question here. And that's what makes it different. And I think
they did find drugs at several places in his clothing, right?
They found drugs in the pocket of a coat that was found in the car, and they found a small amount of drugs in the pocket of his pants. And again, as I argued in a brief, I think that's actually a suggestion that's where the drugs were. That's how people would normally carry things.
He had a record of dealing in drugs, too, isn't it?
That is correct. There's no doubt about that. I agree.
The issue is how much of an inference can you draw from those facts?
The record's devoid of any facts, I think, from which the court could draw an inference that those who sell drugs routinely carry them in their body cavities. Actually, quite the contrary, if you think about it for a minute. As gross as it sounds, if you're going to pull a bag of drugs out of your butt and sell it to someone, that's not likely to go over very well. Again, we're not talking about a smuggling situation like the border, where you have body packers routinely carry drugs, not just in cavities, but they swallow them as well. And to pick up on your question, would the jail be able to give everyone a diuretic or something, whatever you call the word, to make them either throw up or pass it through the other end just because they might have it in their stomach? And does the mere fact that you're a drug dealer mean you're more likely to do it? I would suggest actually not, as opposed to, for instance, a person known to be a mule or a body packer. Those persons, I think, would be more likely to actually be hiding them somewhere. A dealer's carrying a supply around that he needs to sell, and I don't think that's the most likely place he would keep his inventory.
Your client going to be incarcerated during the pretrial period?
I'm sorry, was he?
Well, was he going to be? Was this search part of incarcerating him for an extended period pretrial?
He was originally charged on a state charge, but to try and answer the question, I would say yes. That is to say, they were booking him into the jail on a felony charge. It wasn't likely he was going to get out anytime real soon, although in state court he could easily have made bail. Since they charged him federally, he got detained, and of course he stayed in jail. But yes, he was being booked into the jail. That is correct.
I'm trying to differentiate is between the reason for the search. What was the reason for the search? Was it to find contraband that he could be charged with? Or was this contraband that they were afraid of his introducing into a secure facility?
A perfectly good question, which the record does not answer.
I know.
Well,
no place.
The record failing to answer that, I think the government cannot avail itself of the theory that it was the latter, that is to say, simply to protect the security of the jail in the sense that you mean. I mean, that's the government's argument. They should have introduced some evidence to support it if they wanted to rely on it. And I think what you've got is something that I think hits the nail on the head is from Krashar, where they say the search wasn't used to recover an item that was reasonably believed to be concealed on the person. Rather, the search was used as a means of discovering whether they had that item. And I think that's exactly what happened here. They arrested a person they believed to be a drug dealer. They found drugs, and I believe they were interested in finding more drugs. But the fact of the matter is the record doesn't answer that question, and we're left to speculate on that particular point.
Well, what difference would it make?
Well, I think where the court was going with that is there is a difference between a person who you intend to become a resident of the jail, and therefore you're going to be taking all his clothing and issuing him a uniform. You want to search him because he's going to be there a long time. He might be introducing something into the jail population that you don't want there. Many times people are arrested.
Do you think that would be an appropriate circumstance to conduct this kind of a search?
Well, I believe it would only be an appropriate circumstance if you're either going to say anyone arrested for drugs can simply automatically be searched that way because they can, or if there's some particularized suspicion with the particular person. And I don't believe there was a particularized suspicion with regard to Mr. Logan, and I don't believe it's a correct statement of the law to say that merely being arrested as a drug dealer automatically in every case provides reasonable suspicion to perform a body cavity search.
I want to pick up on maybe a further implication of Judge Cudahy's question. Even if these drugs had been suppressed, there were the other drugs that they had already found on Mr. Logan. What difference to the conviction would this have made? And even if the suppression should have happened at the conviction stage, we don't have rules like that at sentencing. There could still be relevant conduct.
The difference it would have made to the conviction is this happened to be the offense of conviction. It also had a mandatory minimum that the others did not. So it does make a practical difference. I appreciate that point, mm-hmm. but I wouldn't have If it didn't make any difference at all, I wouldn't have raised it. It does make that practical difference. I see my time's about to expire.
Thank you, Mr. Habermill.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. O'Shea.
Good morning. Tim O'Shea for the United States. The district court's decision was right for five different facts here. First, the police officer, Benavides, smelled marijuana as he approached Mr. Logan's car. Secondly, the officer knew that there had been drug buys, undercover drug buys from Mr. Logan in the recent past. Third, he found crack cocaine in the defendant's jacket. That was only 4 grams of crack cocaine all in one plastic baggie. But also, fourth, he found marijuana and $2,209 on the defendant's person, Mr. Logan's person. That quantity of money reasonably suggesting more drug sales.
But, you know, Mr. Habermill says the logic of the government's position is that virtually all drug dealers or people involved with drugs should be strip searched and body cavity searched before they're put into a jail. And that seems to me to be a very broad rule, and I'm disturbed that the government didn't introduce any evidence whatsoever about how many drug dealers of this sort are secreting things in various body cavities. It's a very intrusive kind of search, of course.
Yeah, and that's a valid point. And I don't know.
So are you saying all drug dealers have to go through a body cavity search? And if not, what's the line you're drawing?
That's not what the United States is suggesting. We are not suggesting that categorically all drug dealers should go through it. But it's very circumstance specific.
But I don't understand what are the circumstances. Okay, so he's got some drugs on him, not enormous quantities compared to what sometimes we see.
Well, let's conceding that we shouldn't categorically say, I think we do have a handy analogy here with the consent to search, all right? And that is, but follow me for just a second, Your Honor. Of course, in consent to search, the item, the search is defined in part by what is sought, right? One does not look for stolen cars in a toaster oven. I think it's the same in analogy. I think that analogy applies here to a degree because when one is dealing with a drug dealer, one is more likely to find between his buttocks drugs than when a person is dealing with a person that's stolen cars.
But that's true of all drug dealers. I mean, you could always imagine, you know, a few grams of crack that would fit, if you will, in any number of body cavities. And
sure.
So I don't see how in the next case, in the next case, in the next case, we're supposed to distinguish between the ones where it's okay to do this and the ones where it isn't, except, by the way, Mr. Habermill suggests, which is if you have something suspicious, like somebody saying the first thing he wants to do is run off to the men's room or whatever, something, or somebody's squirming around uncomfortably, something to suggest that the body cavity might be in use.
And that leads to what I believe is the fifth factor here, and that is that Mr. Logan's offense conduct meant that he was going to be in a custodial setting, at least temporarily. And that gets us to concerns about institutional safety. And the cases seem to me to break down, whether they're civil rights cases or criminal cases, between whether the primary purpose is investigatory or for concerns with the institutional safety. And I think this case, for instance, Doe and Barham seem to be investigatory. Crowshar seems to be primarily investigatory, although they introduced the concerns, the institutional concerns as well, versus Peckham and Mary Beth G., which were sort of strictly just for institutional reasons. I think this one's kind of both. I mean, they would reasonably look, they got a person who is.
In the district court, did the government rely on the fact that this being an administrative search as opposed to an investigatory search? Was that argument made to the district court?
I believe it was, Your Honor. I mean, I don't know if it was as explicit as that to say, look, there are two different things that are primary concerns, but I believe the cases relied on certainly show that, and I believe that was the government's concern as well. And it shows that the officer search, the Beloit police search, was not unreasonable. And they have a man here floridly engaged in drug trafficking, a great deal of money on his person. It was not unreasonable for them to see for both the investigation and in this context for institutional safety.
But we don't really know on this record, even though I suspect information like this is probably out there, how frequently at the booking stage, as opposed to once somebody is actually in an institution and maybe a visitor comes and tries to smuggle drugs in that way, we have no idea what the frequency of this behavior is.
That's true. We don't. It's not in the record. I suspect that it would be idiosyncratic almost as it relates to what the officer would have said. Your Honor, these things just aren't terribly well studied.
Well, but they should be studied. I mean, you know, the wardens of prisons and the sheriffs and the other people who operate jails and other detention facilities at a minimum know when they find things, you know, once the inmates are there. You know, they do have things like dry cells. They have other things that are used. And so I think there is some information out there in the world that talks about whether this is a serious risk. And my question is, in a sense, doesn't that inform the reasonableness of the decision to conduct this type of search?
It certainly would. It was just that sort of analysis that helped in Mary Beth G.
Yeah.
Yes, if that was in the record, it would help. If there are no other questions, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Shea. You have 1 minute left, Mr. Habermill.
Thank you. To address those specific points, in Mary Beth G., the actual facts, as it turned out for the study, of course, were in the defendant's favor. That is to say, the study, once done, showed that virtually none of them smuggled drugs in. I said only to say that I think this more evidence, as you just presume that the facts of the person's a drug dealer, gives rise to a reasonable inference that they're, in fact, carrying drugs in their body cavities. The real world may well be very different, and apparently, at least in Mary Beth G., it was. Second, as this court observed in Mary Beth G., the Supreme Court's balancing test established way back with Bell versus Wolfish does not validate strip searches in detention settings per se. That's why it's a balancing test. It needs specific facts to plug into the equation, or you can't tell what the answer is. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Habermill. And you also served by appointment of the court, and please accept the deep thanks of the court for your fine job on behalf of your client. The case will be taken under advisement.